mother died of pneumonia when I was just a kid. Then, one day, hoping to begin a new life away from the scene of all his memories, my father had moved us from Texas to Fort Dupree, South Dakota. Little did I realize that what began in the alleys and backways of this quiet town would end in the badlands of Montana.
Welcome to Now Playing's bonus review of Badlands.
I always wanted to be a criminal, I guess, just not this big one.
A Podbean backer review chosen by Anthony Richards.
The reasons are obvious. I don't have time to go into them right now.
Hosted by Arnie.
Oh, I got some stuff to say. Guess I'm kind of lucky that way.
Stuart.
He was handsomer than anybody I'd ever met. He looked just like James Dean.
And Jacob.
You're quite an individual.
I think I'll take that into consideration.
This podcast will contain detailed plot spoilers and harsh language.
I'll try anything once.
Listener discretion is advised.
Today we're discussing Badlands, starring Martin Sheen, Sissy Spacek, directed by Terrence Malick. This is the Now Playing co-host who will try anything once, including Badlands, Arnie.
And Stuart.
And this is Jacob, and don't make me list the number of instruments my parents made me practice so I wouldn't have time for the ladies.
Clarinet. That explains why you're in a punk band. Hello, November patrons. Who is the lucky person that donated for Badlands? Anthony Richards is the patron that picked this movie. It's one of his favorite films. He wanted to hear us discuss it, especially after we discussed True Romance and Natural Born Killers. I know we brought up Badlands quite a bit during the True Romance show. And after hearing us do what he said, so many classic 70s films, this seemed like one we wouldn't get to another way, and we probably would never be doing a Terrence Malick director retrospective.
When are we going to do The Tree of Life? That one's not divisive at all.
I wanted to start there. How many Terrence Malick films have you seen? And how many are there? Maybe only like six.
Yeah, there's not a whole lot. I actually have some more that I want to see, but I've seen three. I started with Badlands because of... How long ago did we originally do Tarantino?
That was about 4 years ago.
2015, yeah.
Yeah, that's when I first watched Badlands, because I kept thinking of True Romance and Bonnie and Clyde. You're like, no, it's Badlands. You know, Stuart's telling me that, so I'm like, I did watch it then, and then I'm like, okay, what else did this guy do? Oh, Tree of Life. I know people love it or hate it, so I watched that, and then I've also seen The Thin Red Line, but that's it, those three. But I do want to see some more of his stuff. I'm intrigued.
The Thin Red Line, it's been over 20 years. I'm 99% sure I've seen it. That's it with Terrence Malick and me. When I looked him up, I'm like, oh, he's still alive? Oh, he's still working?
He's got a movie coming out this year.
I've heard his name, and because I've heard his name and because we're discussing this almost 50-year-old movie, I just felt for sure he was going to be dead, like Sidney Lumet or something. But no, he's alive and working, but this will be the first film I've seen of his knowing he made it. I don't think I ever knew he was attached to The Thin Red Line.
But you had heard his name before.
Yes.
Yeah, you know, I feel like he's one of those directors, like James Joyce is one of those writers. Everyone knows the name, but nobody would dare watch the movie because they're super challenging. They're true art films. Terrence Malick, I think part of why he has the reputation he did is because he never sold out. Rather than make Michael Jackson videos and commercial films like Peggy Sue Got Married and Color of Money, all the things that Scorsese and Coppola did to survive in the 80s, this guy just walked away. He made two films in the 70s that were beloved. Critics said, you're the next best thing. You're going to win the Oscar. And rather than sell out when the climate of Hollywood changed, he disappeared. People didn't even know where he was. He was rarely photographed. He never gave interviews. He was a phantom. It was Kaiser Sose for 20 years until he came out of the blue, largely due to the work of a lot of actors that wanted to work with him, that had admiration for those first two films. They gave him, opened the doorway, really, so he could make Thin Red Line. And since then, he's been very prolific, but with films that become increasingly more challenging. I will say I gave up. After Tree of Life, I just kind of stopped. It went beyond my ability to appreciate.
Yeah, Tree of Life, it's amazing when you're just watching the universe be born. I think they got the effects guy from 2001 to come back and do all that. And it's like beautiful. And there are parts throughout that movie like where I get emotional and like it's hitting something in me, but I don't know what the movie's about.
Here's what Malick is about in a nutshell. He is fascinated by man's role in the universe, our origin, and whether he can apply philosophical ideas about good and evil to our spirit. That is, as best as I can condense, what seems to cover the umbrella of all his work. Badlands, the film we're here to talk about today, is the film, I think, that is his most commercial, his most well-known, it's his shortest, and the one that is least digressive. It has a plot, you can follow it.
Anthony did say this was the most now-playing-friendly of all Malick's films.
Yeah.
I believe that.
And I think in part that is true because it is a Killers on the Road movie, which is like True Romance. It is referenced in True Romance through the music. And yes, we have certainly talked about things in that genre. I saw this movie around the same time that I first saw Taxi Driver. It was when I was preparing for film school, and it was a name that I knew. I felt like Terrence Malick. Every time I read about a 90s indie director, they were talking about how much they loved Terrence Malick. And then you go back and you're like, he only made two films? What's the big deal? Badlands. Okay, that's the one to see. I remember feeling slightly underwhelmed. I remember expecting greatness and feeling like, well, that was okay, I guess. It was lyrical, lovely to look at, but I was slightly underwhelmed. And then when I really became a fan was I was living in Chicago and they had a theatrical re-release of Days of Heaven. And the thing that I studied about Malick in film school is his cinematography. And that movie is absolutely amazing. They shot it 1 hour each day in the what's called the magic hour, that time when the sun goes down and yet there's still daylight. He insisted his entire movie would be photographed in that light. So it took forever to film this film. It's an incredibly beautiful, lyrical film. To me, it's my favorite of all the ones that I've seen. That was really when I became a fan of him, and I've never gone back to Badlands. To me, it was all about Days of Heaven. And each film I've seen since then, Thin Red Line, The New World, Tree of Life, the things I respect about them, but I always struggle. I struggle with the fact that he wants to be a philosopher and a poet and only occasionally wants to be a storyteller. But it's funny to think out. He started off as a philosophical scholar. He went to Harvard, Oxford, taught at MIT, translated Heidegger into English, like was doing all of this.
Heidegger? That is, ooh, I remember studying Heidegger. That is complex stuff. Like, that is an accomplishment right there.
And then he decides, I'm going to go write screenplays in Hollywood. Literally, the next thing he's doing 2 years later after Heidegger is Dirty Harry. Believe it or not, he's a script doctor on that film.
I saw that. Yeah, the early script he worked on for that.
It's not like anything else, I think, in his resume, but he probably found some fascination with the moral complications of the character of Dirty Harry. I can imagine, you know, again, you do whatever you can when you're trying to break through, but Terrence Malick has never had to sell out. Badlands was a hit and a breakthrough, and from that point, he never had to go make a comic book movie or a sci-fi movie, or if they are those things, they're all in his style. He was enrolled in AFI around the same time as Lynch, and around the same time, Paul Schrader was there writing Taxi Driver. So he was in the thick of things when 70s cinema, Hollywood was changing. And Badlands, maybe reason why it took off and got the funding, was it was part of this very trendy notion that the counterculture liked to think of itself as rebels. And ever since Bonnie and Clyde, there were a lot of movies about people that were called outlaws, young kids in love who would hit the road and kill people, and we are rooting for them. You know, Easy Rider, all these films that really showed that youthful rebellion was about being amoral and anti-establishment. So Badlands, on the surface, it had those qualities, and it was, not unlike Bonnie and Clyde, based on a real story. Did you guys know that what you're watching more or less happened?
Yeah, I know there's a couple that are on a killing spree. This isn't a biopic by any means, though. I mean, but yes, it was inspired by real events.
It's surprising how close it actually is to Charles Starkweather. And I've mentioned before, Marjorie and I have a fascination with serial killers and things. And so Starkweather was one. I knew the name. Marjorie has the trading card for him, but I didn't know all the details.
Does she have the rookie card, though? That's the one worth a lot of money.
So I did look him up after watching this movie, and I'm like, oh,
you basically change the names to protect the guilty, and other than that, it seems like it's a lot the same tale.
Well, one of the arguable things is how much the female participated. Let me put it this way. The girl did go to jail. Unlike in this movie, Carol Ann Fugate was sentenced, I think, until she was about 30. She was in jail. She started her life of crime at 14, so she's even younger than Sissy Spacek in this movie. I think he was 19. They killed 11 people, including her two-year-old sister. They killed more people, and they were less discriminate about who they killed.
Yeah, and she claims to this day that she was not a participant, and she didn't know about all the deaths. She didn't know that he strangled her two-year-old sister. But the jury didn't believe her, but she got parole. She was a model prisoner, so 17 years later, she was let out and ended up living a quiet life under a different name.
And like I said, Bonnie and Clyde, those were real gangsters, but they were turned into myth, really. Arthur Penn, the man that directed that film, really said, let's take them and connect with the now hippie audience of today and make a statement about the 60s. So it has far less to do with bank robbing and the 30s than it really did about what was going on with youth culture and anti-establishment. I think that Malick, he was a student at AFI under Arthur Penn, took that notion into his head and had no interest in creating a docudrama. What we are here, however much it hews to the facts, ultimately, I believe what we see in all of his films usually are symbolic presentations. He's much more interested in what things mean and less about why they happened a certain way. He would never make a very good documentary filmmaker. He's much more spiritual. Again, the word that always comes up, poetics. So Arnie, why don't you tell us what's so lyrical about Badlands?
The movie is set in 1959. Our story begins in the sparsely populated town of Fort Dupree, South Dakota. In that town lives a 25-year-old garbage man named Kit Carruthers, played by Martin Sheen. He doesn't have much education and seems a bit strange, offering his co-worker a dollar to eat a dead dog they found on the road. But Kit meets the object of his affection, quiet and shy 15-year-old Holly Sargas, played by Sissy Spacek. The two see each other in secret, but when Holly's father finds out, he forbids his daughter from seeing Kit. Kit breaks into their home and kills Holly's father, and the two fake suicide and go on the run together. They live in the woods till they're found by some bounty hunters, who Kit kills. They try hiding out a couple other places, but it always seems to end with Kit killing someone until they break into a rich man's house. They steal his car, but leave the man and his deaf housekeeper alive. The police finally track them down in Montana. Holly is split off from Kit, tired of his killing. Kit tries to outrun the cops, but is caught. And we're told in voiceover that Kit was given the electric chair, and Holly got probation and ended up marrying her defense attorney's son. And credits roll. Voiceover. I mentioned it ends in voiceover. Ooh boy, this voiceover. It starts with Sissy Spacek delivering lines just like with no emotion and so quickly that I'm...
That's her character, though! Like, Kit will even mention like how he goes for her because she doesn't have much of a personality. I think it's the perfect voiceover for this character.
I had to rewind it three times. Just, I was like, why are we starting the movie this way? Why is there a data dump? I hoped it was going to be the only voiceover for the film.
Nope.
You've never seen a Terrence Malick movie before. You don't remember the thin red line. That is wall-to-wall voiceover.
Yeah, he's got disembodied voices doing voiceover, characters doing voiceover, just voiceover everywhere.
Yeah, here, though, the way it's delivered, especially this first one, it's just a bad note to open on. It's like, I used to play piano and give recitals, and one time I did play a song and I started on the wrong note. And then I was able to fix it and go on. But here, this is really starting on the wrong note to hear this data dump about how her mother died, her father didn't like this little stranger in the house, and they live in this town. Just her lack of inflection, the way she seems rushed to get all these words out in a short amount of time. I'm rewinding, I'm taking notes, I'm like, what the fuck is this?
See, and I feel... This is a movie I struggle with, like, what is it about? And that's what you do with every Terrence Malick film, I guess, is struggle. What is this about? But Stuart, you're talking about youth cultures and Easy Rider. Watching it this time, this feels like an anti-youth culture film to me, an anti-hippie film, like, because these kids, yeah, they should be cool and hip. And yeah, Sissy Spacek's voiceover, she's bland and like, who would want to date this girl? And Kit is just a screw up. Like, it does feel it's almost a criticism of that whole movement.
Yeah, that's the surprise, is that when I saw it, I just wrote it off as, Oh, another one of these films. There was a million of them. What was so special about this one? I guess it just came out at the right time, hit at the right moment. It was opportunistic. No, it's quite obvious coming back to this. It is almost a parody, a comedy. I'm laughing a lot. I'll put it that way. I think this movie is hysterical, and a lot of it has to do with the fact that we are seeing it from the atypical voice. Typically, in these kinds of stories, it's usually the guy, right? Certainly True Romance, it was all about Christian Slater being enlivened by this bubbly free spirit that saves him from his life.
But it's all told through Patricia Arquette. Again, the voiceover.
Yeah, no, they try to emulate that here. And again, they have the music. I checked. It is not the same. Hans Zimmer theoretically wrote an entirely original score, but it's only a few notes off from Carl Orff's street music.
I told you it was different.
Barely.
Yes. And to be further clear, I don't think Hans Zimmer thought he was getting away from anything. It's a Tarantino project. He was referencing. He wanted people to think about this movie in context with True Romance, but there is a stark difference. And again, it starts, I think, with the idea that we're really with someone who is bored and who will never actually fall. If she falls in love with him, she doesn't love him in the way that we usually expect guys and girls to be in love in a youth culture on the run film.
I almost feel like if this movie were made today, they'd say she has Asperger's or something. There seems to be that kind of disconnect.
Again, I just think she's a kid who doesn't know who she is, and that is the interesting twist on this youth culture film. Like, at one point, she's like, oh yeah, we fell in love and blah, blah, blah. And then at another point, she's like, well, when I move on from Kit, I'm going to get someone that's not so reckless. Like, she's already got plans for the next guy.
Yeah, the way I would describe it is this. She is incredibly naive. There is so much about the world she does not know. This first scene, I think, is telling. Again, always with Malick, he's thought very much about composition. The fact that we begin this movie inside a house and don't see anything of the outside world, it's just her and her dog as her only companion, tells you how sheltered she is. We never see what life was like for her in Texas. It will be Kit that brings her into contact. What she really loves, what Kit brings for her, is the touching of the wilderness. He will bring her to see more of the world than she's been exposed to. So she's very naive. She's not worldly at all, but she is not stupid. Don't make the mistake that because she doesn't know a lot and sometimes seems very disaffected, as you said, almost autistic sometimes about her emotional detachment to some of the trauma that's going on, she is in no way stupid. She's actually quite smart for a 15-year-old girl in this circumstance.
And Kit, we get introduced to him, and I'm probably the only one, but when I see Martin Sheen tossing some garbage, I'm like, is this the whole inspiration for Men at Work?
Well, Emilio and Charlie are here. We will see later on, they have a scene where they're playing on the street corner, so maybe they were inspired by seeing their father do this work. I don't know, but I'll put it this way. That movie isn't half as lyrical as this movie will establish. And I do think that right away, whether you're having problems with it or not, Malick's style is already in evidence. What he's doing here is really textbook him. Like, I mean, the heavy voiceover, the lyricism, the dry observations that are so droll, they almost are funny. Again, I laugh a lot at like, I'll give you a dollar to eat this collie. I don't think that's a collie. You know, like there's just, it's almost like I'm watching the first slacker movie. Or a stoner comedy with no marijuana. Like, there's just something about this that doesn't feel counterculture at all. It feels 90s indie cinema. It feels Gen X.
Yeah, I wasn't sure. Honestly, I watched this movie not knowing anything about it. I didn't know it was going to be about killers on the run. I knew nothing. I mean, from this opening, she does say how she's surprised that the story that started in Texas would end in the Badlands. But I'm like, okay, what is this telling me? I'm trying to figure out, is this a comedy when I see Martin Sheen on the hustle trying to sell a pair of garbage shoes for a dollar and yet offering somebody a dollar to eat a dead dog? And one of my favorite minor characters, there's a ton of minor characters in this, Kit's boss. You hear the headlines, it's been in all the news, you're fired.
Mm-hmm. And it's just the way he gets non-professional actors to kind of deliver. There's something about this that feels authentic is not the right word. It does not feel like reality. It feels very much created, but there is something that is if not anti-Hollywood, maybe even anti-movie about it. Like, we're not used to seeing things downplayed in this way. Typically, you want to offer grabbers. You want to show the passion of two people falling in love. Quite the opposite here. This is about a girl that's twirling a baton on a lawn, and here's a guy offering to walk her down the street, one that she may never have walked down before. She loves him for the opportunity to learn things, and she loves him because he looks like James Dean. And that's really where we get into sort of the symbolism of all of this, is that these are two kids that are going to represent the 50s coming into the turbulent 60s.
Yeah, and I do think she's smitten with him. I mean, he's worldly, he's quite a bit older. What I get from her voiceover and her performance is that her favorite times are the times when he does take her out and she's no longer in the house under her dad's thumb.
Well, you're getting to the dad, and that's obviously the big attraction here. Is like, what the first scene tells you is that her mom is dead of pneumonia and her dad is emotionally not available. He considers her a stranger, a little stranger, and he, even now, like, is painting in the backyard and just doesn't give her anything. So here's a guy that gives her attention, is going to take her away from all of that. She's hungry for that. Again, I don't think she knows Kit, and the more she learns about him, the less she appreciates him.
Yeah, we'll see. They'll finally have sex, and she's like, oh, that's it? That's what everyone's talking about? Like, she's losing her virginity, and both of them are pretty nonchalant about it. Like, it doesn't even seem like they do it that often. It just feels antithetical to what you'd get with your normal youth culture film, where sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
Yeah, a big movie of the late 60s was a retelling of Romeo and Juliet with Olivia Hussey. And again, that passion of the structure of the time are trying to keep us away. They're, you know, because you're white and I'm black, that they're not going to let us be together. All of that stuff, usually you want that to translate. That's why we have the right to kill the man, is because they're so constrictive of us. Here, these are people that are going to do things largely because they're bored and because they don't have any moral compass.
Yeah, that whole sex scene, what happens before is she throws out like a sick catfish and she talks about how bothered she was by that. Only Terrence Malick could come up with a scene like that, but like she just tosses this fish out into the grass, and that was a bigger emotional moment than losing her virginity.
Yeah, it's a world where everyone is really doing things to see if they can feel. What she says is her fish is sick, so she just tosses him out into this watermelon patch, just gasping, and then she's like, that's the only thing I did wrong. Well, it's pretty bad. That's we would, if this were modern day, we would be sitting you down, there would be a clinician, and we would be trying to get at what's going on in your little head here, Holly, but we're not in that time. This is a time where it is just do what dad says, and nobody's looking at the psychology of children. They're off on their own.
So I do have to ask, because watching this film, talking about the relationship she has with her dad, and these are not thoughts I had the first time I watched it, but then after seeing Thin Red Line and Tree of Life, I started, okay, this is what Malick's about. He does get into a lot of spirituality. He'll use Judeo-Christian references and symbols. I don't think he strictly falls along those lines, but he uses that as a reference point for Western audiences. And so watching it this time, I'm like, is this an Adam and Eve story? You have her dad. He's only named father. We see him wearing white, even though he's a painter. That seems like a bad decision, like these white suits, and he's painting landscapes, you know, God the creator. I am wondering, is this about moving away from God and that kind of separation? And this is like humans trying to struggle and find their morality as, you know, she's dealing with sex and dead fish.
Oh, I absolutely think that's there. And again, the more you watch Mallet, the more you know that kind of iconography is what drives him. He's always looking to recreate moments in the Bible that are debatable, the things that a million sermons have been written about. He puts them in a new context, usually the context he understands, which is the childhood of the 1950s. Since he is from that period, he starts there and uses that iconography. And I think you're right to think that he has created this area for her and that she is going to leave with this man, be cast out. It's not a clear-cut recreation of the story of the fall of man, but I definitely think there's no way that he's not thinking about that imagery as he looks at these kids trying to find their Eden. And I think the reason why Kit is into her is that he is just someone that needs attention so badly. It wouldn't work if she talked. If she had a personality, there would be no room for him because he is going to dominate. What he most wants is someone to sit there and let him just run off of the mouth at all his crazy thoughts, which at first sound cute. I mean, they are unusual. And the fact that it comes from her it almost downplays how severe that is. The fact that he's up all night hearing the sound of the sea or seashells in his ears, I'm like, that's schizophrenia. Like, this is very bad that this man is having auditory hallucinations.
I wasn't sure if it was some kind of tinnitus or something, but yeah, I did catch that as a little odd. You know, it seems like it's a very chaste thing. I mean, she is so young and he is 10 years older. And in real life, Martin Sheen was in his 30s when filming this. He's playing 25. She's 15. And I'm much more put at ease when the voiceover says he's not interested in her for sex. I'm like, well, good, because that's, you know, not acceptable in today's society.
Yeah, but it's an unreliable narrator. That is the character Holly saying that that's what he told her, but clearly they have sex by the river. And so the reason why he might have told her that is because he's still working her on that. Obviously, he has some issues with sex, and they do have sex, and some of this is a physical relationship. But to her, that isn't the thrust of it. He loves her for her. Again, this is a man that's giving her attention, unlike her father, who never will look at her. And so she's just happy to be accepted.
I think Holly likes the attention that, yeah, she doesn't get from her dad. I think Kit is in it because she's easy to manipulate. He likes to just talk and expound like he knows everything about the world. And it's always kind of silly if you actually try to piece together what he's saying. But I think he is looking for someone impressionable that will just kind of go along with him.
Yeah, she says early on, long before they're ever in trouble with the law, he wanted to die with me and I dreamed of being lost forever in his arms. So again, she must have been picking up early on, without maybe even fully being conscious of it, that there's something very dangerous about this guy, that mortality is coming up. Wanting to be dead is a warning sign, everyone. A red flag should that come up on first date conversation.
Yeah, I loved the little detail that he forged his own signature every time he signed his name. Like, is that actually a forgery if you're doing it? But that way nobody else could fake it on important things.
Yes. Who would know what the word paranoia even means? A child in 1959, I doubt, would even be able to say that in English or Spanish, which is what she's studying when he's coming and hitting on her on the porch.
But while I definitely take him as odd, again, I'm watching this. I never even watched a trailer. I didn't know where this was going. I did start to get warning signs from him again and again. Whereas, yeah, she is so young, I couldn't figure out. And yeah, maybe this is how Malick wanted Spacek to play it, but there's so little emotion coming from her at all. And yes, as you mentioned, while they said he wasn't interested in her for sex, the post-sex scene, again, she's just so unemotional, I can't get a bead on her. Are they both mentally ill? I mean, I think what we're going to find out with him is he is a true sociopath.
You know, here's the thing, and my general impression about Malick's work is that he's not really interested in diagnosing. Again, these are representational characters. The fact that she's going to, her alter ego is going to be Priscilla, and that, yeah, he's going to be James. Again, they're playing the roles of the icons of the time, that they are the 50s. Like, that's what they represent. They bought into the Americana of those times, but their world is small and boring. I think you get, and the way that, like, he takes her on that date to Main Street and they just look at, like, paper bags blowing down the street, that this is not a world where you can fall in love. There's no love here to fall into. And so they are looking for a place where they can feel. That is why they will eventually try to escape to the garden. Again, I mean, I do think these religious ideas are there.
Yes. I mean, I'd not seen this film, but I was definitely thinking Natural Born Killers when the father says she can't see him, and so he shows up at the house with a gun.
Before that, we must talk about what is the first psychotic kill of the film. It is not done by Kit. It is done by a father so angry that his daughter hasn't been truthful about where she's been spending time after school. He's going to take that dog we saw in the first shot out into the field and shoot it dead.
I watched this film with my wife, who is, I've never met anyone who loves dogs as much. She, you know, we support animal charities all the time and things. She introduced me to the website doesthedogdie.com, which she visits like a parent's guide before seeing movies to know if a dog will die in the movie. So she's watching this with me and dog dies. She had a reaction to that of
utter. I did too. I mean, yeah, why would, I mean, aren't we all? Like, I feel bad for this father. I know that he has been emotionally stunted since his wife died, but damn, I mean, that dog is not the reason why she was stepping out.
Yeah, but here's the weird thing. So when I was in high school, I remembered reading a story. It was about a girl who got in trouble with her parents. They made her shoot the dog, and then she took the gun and shot herself. I turned that into a punk song in our band. I'm like, I don't know. Maybe they were just big fans of Badlands and that's why they decided to kill this girl's dog. But like, I had read a story about this happening in real life. So it was weird, like seeing this and go, oh, this may have been the inspiration for that.
It helps stay on the character's side, right? I mean, I'm not looking at this as a allegorical film. I'm taking this as a narrative. And if we're going to have these two be our protagonists, we don't want to hate them from the beginning. So this act will make it so that when he kills the father, we don't really find it to be bad. In fact, Marjorie was in the room with me going, that's what you get!
I wouldn't go that far, but yeah, it helps you get on Kit's side. But again, Kit is a bit of a psychopath and just as controlling as that dad. Like, he doesn't tell Holly what the plan is. He just goes to her house, walks in, starts packing up her stuff. It didn't seem like she knew that was the plan.
Yeah, I don't think there is a plan. I mean, I think there are thoughts in his head, and he's kind of improvising here. He's like, suppose I shot you. He's almost imagining it right there on the spot. Like, okay, well, I guess since I'm holding a gun and you're calling the authorities, this is the point in time where I have to shoot you. And yeah, big laugh out line. This tells you where maybe my sense of humor is. When Sissy Spacek gets on the ground with him, is like, Daddy, are you okay? I mean, like, yes. My God. No, he's not okay.
And even Kit's response, if you want to call the police, that's fine. Won't be so hot for me. Like, he's so nonchalant about it.
Again, a lot of indie filmmakers' comedies that I do like, the slacker comedy, the deadpan comedy, Richard Linklater, Jim Jarmusch, they play with this kind of tamped down emotions. Well, you're laughing because boredom has led people to do outrageous things, and we're having an outrageous reaction to things that they can't feel. That's the tension of the scene and of a comedy like that. One thing that I've read, I didn't pick up on any time I've watched this movie. I've seen it 3 times now. Is Kit a Korean War vet? Somebody wrote that, and I don't know where they would have gotten it in this film. There's a lot of details, and maybe there was something going on in the frame that I didn't recognize. Are we to think in any way that he's shell-shocked, or that some of this violence comes from him being a product of war?
I never got a sense of that.
I rewatched the beginning of this film twice and saw nothing that would indicate it.
Okay.
And if he was 25, when he's listing his careers, he never lists that he was in the military. He lists that, you know, he sold garbage.
Right. Yeah, you come out with the GI Bill, you go to college, you don't go to the slaughterhouse or to, yeah, doing the odd jobs that he was maintaining. I don't know where they got that. But again, I'm willing to believe that it's possible reading there, but that's not how I'm looking at Kit. I don't feel like Kit is damaged by where he came from. I see it more as, yeah, I suppose, untreated, undiagnosed mental illness.
I mean, again, I don't even think he revels in doing bad. I think he can't tell the difference between what we consider bad and consider good. It's like he's so nonchalant. And like you said, imagine now if I shot you. He's off in his head, like he can't distinguish reality from fantasy.
Well, and here's the thing. If Malick's going for some kind of spiritual allegory, narrative, lyrical story, whatever, however he tells his movies, if you read the Bible, there's crazy, especially the Old Testament. Cain and Abel, like the first murder. God's like, hey, Cain, why'd you kill Abel? That's bad. God protects Cain, too, even though he's killed his brother. Like, he puts this mark on him. So everyone knows, hey, don't mess with this guy. God does not want you to kill him for killing his brother. So it's this weird morality if you really study the Old Testament. And if this is kind of an Adam and Eve early man type thing, figuring out morality, it's, yeah, we're going to kill, but we're not going to get crazy emotional about it. It's this weird murkiness trying to feel out, like, what is right and what is wrong.
Here's what I would say to that, jumping off of that idea, is I do feel like there's something about them in their state that makes them innocent. And I know that feels silly because they're killers. She's not a killer, but she abets it. She did kill that catfish. I mean,
that doesn't count.
It was sick.
I don't know. But yes, they both struggle to feel something. And I feel like if they're innocent, it's because they just don't know the hurt of the world and what it could cause the actions that they're thinking of doing. So everything is an experiment. Everything is like they're trying it for the first time. I killed him. What should I do? I feel like when she's mad at him, she's not even mad for killing her father. She's just like, I feel like that's what I should be doing. I don't know my role. And so in that way, they both feel like babes in the woods.
It's funny seeing how Kit reacts because he leaves for a while and goes to like a bus depot to record a record.
This is cool. I wish this were around now. 50 cents.
This was a real thing. My grandfather, who's in the music business, had a personal one. There are records of my dad as a kid talking because they had a machine like this. The funny thing is that booth, the window is cracked open and he's like confessing to the dad dying and committing suicide. It's like, there's people there. They can just hear you.
But no one cares. Again, this is a world where no intervention, no one is going to have an emotional reaction here. But yeah, what I loved about that scene is the monologue is funny. It plays to my sensibilities of humor. Almost everything that Martin Sheen says in this movie, but like, we've decided to kill ourselves. And like, we as an audience are like, what? Oh my God. He is going to not only kill himself, but Sissy Spacek. He's going to go back and kill her. I'm so worried for her. And then, you know, he's like, I don't have time to go into it right now. And then he runs out of things to say by the end. I'm like, but come on, you could elaborate on this. And then to find out all of this, in his mind, this is a plan to leave a record playing this confession.
Yeah, this is how they're going to get off.
So that they'll think that they burned up in the house. Meanwhile, that flame is obviously going to consume the record player. No one is ever going to hear this recording. They're obviously going to find one body and not three. Like,
yes.
The level of idiocy of his plan reminds me of Coen Brothers or these kinds of heist plots, or when we follow dumb criminals. It's almost its own subgenre where usually we want to see people that are really good at doing bad. Like, that's what fascinates us. It's a different feeling to watch people that aren't very good at casting plots that, yeah, this is the way they think they're going to get away with killing the father and escaping to a new alternate reality. The fact that they're going to take a lamp and try and live in the woods just says everything to me.
Didn't they leave the record outside the house?
Yes, but they also lit the flames right next to it.
Oh, I thought it was down in the basement where the dad's body was. Okay.
No, it was, they pulled it all out. And yeah, meanwhile, like, she's bringing oil paintings. And like, again, this is what I mean about innocence and naivete. They're not stupid, but they don't know what they're doing and they don't know where they're going. And everything is an experiment to see if they could feel anything at all.
And I also feel like there is something maybe about materialism, like Kit, he's always digging through the trash, trying to find stuff to sell. And yeah, they grab just the weirdest stuff to take with them. And like, at one point, Kit's just like burying stuff or just tossing it in the garbage. There is a weird focus on just objects that they take with them.
If Malick has a theme in a lot of his movies, is what is man when he's removed from modern society? When he steps away from all of these things, houses, electricity, clarinets, what have you. The interesting part is now that we move to Act Two, okay, so now they've created Eden. They're going to build a tree house that has incorporated still some of modern day things. There are chiclets there. There are things that you would have in a real house. How different is their world going to be? And how, I guess, pure is the word to think about, is their lives now?
And I do love the cinematography because it does feel like Eden, because this is a Malick thing. Like, I'm just going to show some bugs and some plants and animals crawling around. Like, just do some scenery shots.
My favorite moment in the whole movie, the one that just, and again, it's because it shows her as a thinker and so naive at the same time, is when she pulls out her dad's stereopticon, the thing he uses to help paint the paintings, and she's imagining the past. She's looking at all of these old things, like the Sphinx is there and all these historically important moments that are kind of like the Viewmaster. I don't know how else to describe it. And then she ends up saying, where would I be at this very moment if Kit had never met me? Or killed anybody. Like, I mean, that just, again, I'm laughing a lot. Are you guys laughing at this movie?
I do laugh at times.
I found a few things funny, but I never laugh out loud. I find things quirky, but mostly I am trying to do what Malick, you say, is not. I am psychoanalyzing these people and trying to figure out how the hell she's going along with this guy, because she, when we look at the movies we reviewed that were inspired by this, we very clearly know where the woman stands on everything. We look at True Romance and we look at Natural Born Killers, and Mallory was as into the killing as Mickey, and Patricia Arquette
was very much on board with Christian Slater killing her pimp.
But she was kind of a fantasy girl. Like, she wasn't real. Like, that's the thing about all the other ones, is that, like, this is a girl that never existed. This is the girl that the guy wishes he had, but doesn't actually have a material reality. The difference is, here, I feel like we're getting a real 15-year-old girl's perspective.
I'll agree with you there, but I will say the first time I watched this, like you, Arnie, I do think I really struggled because I was trying to put together the narrative. It was my first Malick film. I didn't know what he was all about. And then I watched some of his other ones, and it helped recontextualize when I came back to watch it this time, which I feel like that is probably the most Terrence Malick way to watch one of his films, like see the future stuff, then go back in time. And that's just how he kind of is. But yeah, if you're trying to make narrative sense, that's not what this film is about. It is more of an emotional, a feeling film. Like, what are these characters? How do you feel? Yeah, that sense of naivety and kid, is he badass or is he kind of just dumb and improvising? I kind of let the narrative thing go this time because that's not what it's about.
I'm with you on that. That's what I'm doing, is trying to figure out, is she along for the ride with this? Is she into the killings as much? Because you say she's 15. Now, I wasn't a 15-year-old in the 50s, but I remember very clearly being 15 and how I felt at 15, and I wouldn't be blasé if somebody came in and killed my parents. I mean, I would have a reaction to that. That reaction might have been celebration, but I'd have had a reaction to it. To see her so disaffected, I'm trying to figure out, what is motivating them? What is their goal? Because it appears to be with each other. You know?
No, she says right in here in this moment, she's wondering, at the same time she's wondering what would be if her mom hadn't died and all that, and I'm wondering what the man I'm going to marry is like.
Yes.
She actually wonders what he's doing right this minute. She knows very well this is temporary. This is transient. She's not wanting to be with Kit. She's going with the flow because, well, it's somewhere to go.
And I found that line very telling, but I also was like, I can't figure out why she'd stick around with him if it wasn't some sort of infatuation. And the body language and the scenes we're seeing in this montage don't necessarily match her words in that regard, because we're seeing them walk together, hold hands, snuggle.
Yeah, but things aren't all going great. Like, she talks about how they have bad times, and you get that moment. There was an earlier conversation where Kit asked her, does anyone ever call you Red? And she's like, no, I hate that. And there's a moment of frustration. Kit can't catch that fish for dinner, and he calls her Red, and you're like, ooh. Like, when you're able to take a simple single word like that and put so much meaning behind it, that works for me. Like, when he calls her Red, you know, ooh, that's not good, because she had such a strong reaction against being called that nickname.
Yeah, they're lucky bounty hunters come, because God knows if they had been left to their own devices much longer, they would have killed each other. I think it's very clear it's breaking down. If she's having fantasies as, oh yeah, sometimes I wonder if you'll fall, I'll wish you fall into the river and drown so I could watch. I mean, that is something she says to the audience as he's there trying to catch fish, eventually pulling out a gun and shooting fish in the river. This is all going badly.
Yeah, I love, like, they wake up one morning, she's like, the chicken died.
Yeah, the answer is, if we thought that the problems were society and the pressures that father and everything were putting on us, that isn't the case. The truth of the matter is, running off and having this nature adventure is not bringing us closer to each other. What it is doing, I think, for Holly, is bringing her close to God. She talks about how she likes the nature, and when she's smiling and having fun, a lot of it is the engagement with the natural world that's going on.
And when those bounty hunters show up, this is where you get those disembodied voices. Like, you get these weird German chants throughout the film, but at this point, they're like telling them, get out of here, run. It's almost like God, yeah, speaking to her and warning her at this point.
Yeah, this must be how Martin Sheen got Apocalypse Now, right? Because he's totally outfitted this whole treehouse with, like, really cool Goonies traps. And, you know, he's diving in under, like, he's suddenly dug in tunnels. If you look at this representationally, if you're not looking at this stuff as, okay, he's James Dean and she's Priscilla Presley, and we've now moved into this warlike scenario out into the jungle. Again, I think it's asking to think about the archetypes moving into the Vietnam 60s. Terrence Malick is asking you to go in that direction. Representational, symbolic ideas. I don't think this movie totally is fulfilling if you think of it as straight drama.
No. I'll say it isn't.
Yeah, that's how I felt the first time. And when I was able to recontextualize it, this second time was much more satisfying, knowing what I should be looking for.
Right.
And so eventually they go back to Cato, which is, you know, his one good friend on the garbage route that didn't seem to mind that he was slacking off and just being so weird. Cato is now babysitting somebody's farm and has seemingly agreed to keep them hidden here for the price of a chicken.
Yeah, this does not take long to go bad. But at this point, I mean, we've seen Kit killed the three bounty hunters. The body count is going up. And again, Holly just is impassive. No reaction whatsoever. She's more than happy to go to this guy's house and just have dinner.
Yeah, I would say if you're wondering why she's this way, it probably has a lot to do with unresolved feelings about her mom being died. That she lost her mother and that was traumatic, and all she got was a dog and a father that wouldn't talk about it and moved her out of the house full of memories and eventually shot that dog. Yeah, you've seen someone that is really emotionally closed up trying to open up. The story I see being told in this movie this time is a girl that can't feel anything, has been numbed by early trauma, but who is slowly, through the magic of a psychopath, is being introduced to feeling from the natural world. She knows that he's not her love, but she loves that he's leading her towards an eventual love, that one day there'll be a man she'll marry, and he's going to be her ticket. That's why she rides along. Again, she started locked up in a room in a house, and I think that she's very excited to be seeing things she's never seen before. I don't think she likes the violence. She kind of justified the bounty hunters because he said, well, they weren't real cops, and he supposedly heard them whispering that they just wanted the money. You know, again, we can read between the lines. This guy's really bad news, but she's still more or less with him until I think he kills Cato. When he shoots his supposed friend in the stomach and two other teenagers roll up here and he probably kills them too when he throws them in the cellar, I think she wants out then. I think she very much would like to find that Prince Charming that this guy isn't. I do love the way she describes that big emotional shutdown, though. She feels kind of blah, like sitting in a bathtub with the water run out. I mean, I just think there's some kind of local color that Terrence Malick does a lot that not everyone can do. Like, it's a talent to be able to take a small, seemingly insignificant moment and give it the weight of something that tells you the whole character of someone. That was poetic writing I really responded to.
And it's after this killing where you do get kind of that sensationalized Bonnie and Clyde montage where you're seeing the outside world react to them. You know, it's like the Russians have invaded. They're so notorious.
But it's all told by her, and you're wondering, well, how does she know any of this? How does she know anything? Is this something that he's telling her? Does she just believe? Or is she older now and narrating this as someone that has gotten facts? I mean, she does know eventually it will end in the Badlands of Montana at the beginning. So, again, we can't entirely trust the voiceover here.
Yeah, and I took this to be objective. I didn't take it to be her fantasy because, again, this is being told in retrospect by her. But now that you mention it, yeah, this could just be her fantasy of what people are doing.
There's no way the whole country is looking for them. I mean, like, that line in and of itself. And the fact that we see, like, one policeman with a shotgun walking, like, kids from kindergarten to, like, wherever yeah. they go. I mean, again, there's probably some truth to this because the 50s did panic. I mean, you know, like, there was a lot of paranoia. Reds in every corner. Again, that it was like the Russians had invaded is the line that's used. I think that is true that 50s conservative small town mentality would be very threatened by the idea that killers were on the loose. I also just think this is part of her naivete. She believed a story of their grandeur because Kit believed they were the most important people in the world.
And then we go to a rich man's house, as they say. Again, this is where I struggle with this film. There's weird little details, like they're going to knock on the door, a maid's going to answer, but we're going to find out the maid is deaf.
So how did she hear the knock?
There's that, but what does this mean that the maid is deaf? Why do you put that detail in there?
It's kind of like, you know, Wes Anderson is a big fan of Terrence Malick. You know, he just has a lot of characters with details. The weirder, the better. If there can be something unusual about someone, slip it in. A birthmark, a lisp, a funny walk.
It is funny because we'll see the rich man, he has like a bell, like you ring the bell to call the maid over. She can't hear anything. I'm getting some jokes from this. I'm just wondering if there's a deeper meaning having this deaf maid.
Yeah, that I can't speak to. I don't have the philosophy background that Terrence Malick has. And so if this is in any way referenced to anything or what he's going for, I like to read articles about people that know more about that stuff that can tell me. But I have no interpretation of what symbolically could be going on here. What I appreciate appreciate about this moment is that these people have found supposedly the good life. You know, first they tried to make the natural world work. That didn't work. They tried to go live with friends. They don't have any. And so now this is as good as it gets in 1959. This is a mansion and...
He gets to use a dictaphone.
Yeah, he puts on hats and gets to use a device much like the one that was in the train station. And it doesn't seem to make them any happier either. Again, where is their place in this world? I think that this is the story of a girl who is trying to find that. And that she disguises herself. When they're finally ready to leave, she puts on a shawl that gives her the impression of the Virgin Mary. It would be interesting to know what Malick thinks about it, but part of the reason why he has this great reputation is he doesn't give interviews. He doesn't really do commentary tracks. He's not going to tell you what all of this loaded imagery could mean. And so it just leaves people to have endless interpretations about what it all is.
I'll say on a narrative level, I think there's some good tension here. Like someone knocks on the door. They got like some blueprints, I think, and the guy's got an appointment with the rich man and who knows what that's all about. But the fact that, again, Kit is so nonchalant and we've seen what he does and he doesn't get excited and emotional about it. I'm waiting for something horrible to happen. But he's like, no, I'll give him your message. And then he kind of tosses it away and he's like, hey, we're going to borrow your Cadillac. And like, they just take off. But you're waiting for the next death.
The charm of Kit is that he insists he's borrowing, that he leaves a list and like he's taking groceries, but he's going to, in his mind, he's going to come back one day and repay all of this because he's no criminal. Or, I mean, it's almost sweet. It's innocent in how deluded this man is. But things are going very badly. Holly is even saying when she's wandering on the lawn, I was so lost in thought that I didn't think of escaping, which again, what are you thinking about if not getting out of this situation? But the passion is gone. We know from this point with nothing else but them driving around, sometimes not even on roads, just rolling through dust plains, following telephone wires. They're off course in their relationship. There's not a clear idea about where they could go to be happy.
Yeah, there's something about being in civilization that's kind of what makes you human, because Holly gets super excited when she sees a train because that's the first sign of civilization she's seen in weeks, and she said she felt like an animal before that. There's some interesting lyricism going on in this, which some people are going to struggle with. I'll put that out there. Not everyone's going to like that artiness, but I do like little details like that.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was rolling over me. I am the newbie here. I only watched the movie once.
Arnie, the first time, I was mystified the first time I watched this. So don't feel bad.
As was I. Underwhelmed was the word that I came to. What I most responded to was that it was lovely to look at. And that's inarguable. There are three cinematographers on this film. I don't know how they achieved the looks, but this is all pre-digital world. One of them is Tak Fujimoto, who would go on to shoot Silence of the Lambs and all of Jonathan Demme's and much of M. Night Shyamalan's work. All good DP work. You will study Malick if you study the art of cinematography. But that wasn't enough. When I saw this, I'm like, but what's the there? And I don't think I was getting the humor. I mean, I can definitely say what I responded to this time that I did not feel in my initial watching was that all of this, for me, it was endlessly hysterical the way that she would downplay the outrageousness of the situations in her voiceover and the fact that she was rolling with things that no 15-year-old should have to accept. But she has vowed she's not going to tag along with any hellbent types should she meet them again in the future. As they're rolling in through the night, she knows, I mean, she's even actively telling him at this point, what are you going to do in Canada? You're going to be a Mountie. He's like, yeah, I can ride, shoot. I don't mind the cold.
I love he's got a whole plan for it. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got a plan like he has a plan of anything else. If it pops into his head, that's a plan. But yeah, they're going to have one moment, and there is something sweet in goodbye, right? Like, I don't want them to be together. I think it'll be great when she gets away, but I do feel she has been with him, and what she even told the rich couple is she feels in some ways protective of him. She's the parent figure. She knows that he's damaged, that he's worried about dying alone in some shootout, and so that she just needs to ride this out and get him to some kind of conclusion. It's kind of a mature stance, really. I would have thought that a lot of people would have been deluding themselves into we're in love and that's all that matters, and anyone that stands in our way deserves what they get.
That's the trope. I mean, that's the Bonnie and Clyde trope, and that's all those films you said were inspired by this follow that trope.
Yeah. And so, again, I think that's what makes this movie very, very different, although it's subtle. You wouldn't necessarily suspect it was any different from the others until you really start paying attention to the nuances.
And it does follow the Starkweather tale, though, because the girlfriend there did break away from Starkweather before the end.
The surprise is this is called Badlands. I lived for a short period of time in South Dakota. Highly recommend if you ever get up there. The Badlands National Park is beautiful. I don't know if you guys know it, but it's very unique rock formations carved out by the wind. There's nothing else I've ever seen in the world that looks like it. Would be great to have a climax set in that park.
In the Badlands, we never get there, right?
Maybe that's some kind of metaphorical point that they don't get to the Badlands.
That is the mountain. Yeah, Kit's going to keep talking about, if I could have got to that mountain over there. You always see this mountain off in the distance. I guess that's the Badlands, but yeah, it's a destination they will never arrive to.
Yeah, I think, you know, because it's Badlands, and again, it's just a word that has so much connotation to it that, again, read 100 different ideas into that. The point that they don't get there is really just a statement that there is no happy end for them. There is no place in this world for this couple to work it out. And so, is it going to end in gunfire? Bonnie and Clyde famously ends with both of them riddled with bullets, one of the most violent scenes of its time. They don't go there.
Yeah, Holly quickly gives up, and what does Kit do? He, like, grabs the bumper off a car or something, uses it, you know, pulls a Captain America and uses it as a shield.
I love it. It's just scrap metal from something. Yeah, I don't, just a hubcap, practically. And he's going to just keep marching on. He shouts, all right, we'll rendezvous in 5 years at some dam then. I mean, like, yeah. Again, this man is scheming. He has no plans, but he's always scheming. I see a big difference. And, yeah, he's just going to ride it out. And what we see is that he shoots out his own tire. When he realizes he could get away, I take it to mean the thought of being completely alone is more horrifying than not having an audience.
But that was told through her point of view, because she says, I suspect, because of that, I don't know if he really shot out his own tire or if that is a reenactment of her supposition. I can't tell.
I do think he did it because, again, I'm going to go back to the Bible here. What does he do after he shoots that tire up? He grabs, it's a very weird scene. He grabs rocks and he just stacks them. But that is something that happens all the time in the Old Testament. You hear about these little pillars of rocks that these prophets build where they talk to God. So I don't know. Is it this moment realizing, hey, I could be a famous criminal? Like, that is his deity. And he's building his little altar to worship that as he gives up. Because, yeah, he was trying to kill these cops. He's trying to give away. But then he just turns himself in practically.
I think he wants his life to have a point. You know, he didn't want to be a garbage man. He didn't want to pick through other people's lives. Like, he wanted something to hold on to. And early on, after they had sex, remember, he wanted to crush each other's hands with rocks. Like, the suggestion was, well, some people get tattoos. We'll just bleed from our fingers because we're going to take this giant boulder and smash our hands to signify that we've had sex together. Again, the man is just desperate to make any kind of mark that he can. And this is kind of what he fell into because it's what his crazy mind led to. Yeah, the fact that he makes a pile of rocks there, I guess it's a monument to the fact that this is where he got caught, and he'd like to think that he's as important as Jesse James or any other outlaw.
Oh, yeah, you see that when he's caught and giving, like, press interviews and standing there so nonchalantly and, like, asking the cop, hey, can you loosen these handcuffs a bit? They're a little tight.
Yeah, the cops are going to even say he looks like James Dean, that thing that Holly said early on in the movie. And this is a weird shift of tone because this does feel more conventional, like, oh, here's what the film's about, how we take our criminals in America and turn them into celebrities if they got a little charisma. And isn't this all, like, it weirdly plays out that way to me, at least.
Yeah, you know, here's the thing is, like, I never wanted them to be together until this moment, and now I'm feeling bad. He sees her one more time, and he's like, there's a lot of other boys out there for you. You're going to have a lot of fun. Fun is everything to him. I mean, he kept bringing that up in the record confession. Oh, we're still having fun. Like, he wanted a good time. It's sad that it's over. And he's asking these people that genuinely like him. I mean, he's entertaining the crowd of National Guard people that have gathered around the airplane hangar. And he's asking them, am I going to take the juice? Yes. The answer is this character has 6 months and before he hits the electric chair. And that, you got to feel bad. I mean, again, I see innocence here. I know I shouldn't. I mean, I know that this is because the movie is constructed in a way that it's asked me to care about this person. But yeah, I can't help feeling like he doesn't deserve this fate.
Yeah, there's something naive about him. And if you're looking this more lyrically, where this is about just, you know, the human condition and us trying to figure out morality where maybe God is dead, as the father is when he gets shot. You know, it there is, like, you kind of feel bad. He's struggling. He's, you know, usually an easy rider or those kind of movies. Like, yes, we're on the hippie side right away. But here it's like, oh, no, here's the struggle of actually trying to be counterculture and try to find that way. And so, yeah, I agree. He's done a lot of horrible things, but there is some sympathy because I see this as a person who's struggling to find out what's right and wrong in their life.
Going back to the Garden of Eden, it's always a point of real contention of, like, why did God cast us out? We were just human. What was so unforgivable about us that made us lose paradise? And I think that's a similar sentiment I'm feeling in these final moments.
I'm a little frustrated that, again, it's happening in voiceover. I mean, I don't know that I want a montage that ends with him in the electric chair either, but I think I would have preferred to see something more final if he is going to fry than what we get here.
Well, he's taken up into the heavens. And, you know, earlier, when it was still the good times, he had that moment where he found a red balloon in the trash and put all the tokens that meant something about their love and sent it up into the air. And so, again, it's just leaving us with their last moments together while they're still together up in the air. It's right before the fall. And I guess you could argue this whole movie is about the fall.
Well, let's see where our cards fall. Jacob Stewart, do you recommend Badlands? Jacob.
So the first time I watched this movie, after Stewart say, no, True Romance, it's like Badlands, it's not like Bonnie and Clyde. I watched this, I'm like, well, this is pretty much like Bonnie and Clyde, because like that is the level I could comprehend this film on. Here's two people that fall in love and go on a killing spree. And yes, I recognize it was artsier than that. And you had this beautiful cinematography and these weird asides, but I'm like, it's just basically like that movie. And then I got the context. And so I don't know if this is a recommend or not. It's probably Malick's most conventional film, but it's pretty much a capital A art film as well, and people are going to struggle with that. And I know I had that struggle, and I watch it now, I'm like, is he saying this? Is there a there? I don't know. I just know I do get things out of moments here and there. I don't know what exactly the entire point of the film is, but I know there are moments that really do speak to me, and I really do see someone who's trying to say things on a deeper level, and so I enjoy that struggle more the second time watching it. But again, heads up, this isn't going to be sitting back and watching Avengers Endgame, where you just enjoy all the explosions and punches and all that. I think to appreciate this film, you're going to have to work your way through it, and maybe watch it a couple times, but I think it's a journey worth going through. I do like artistic films that challenge you and you struggle through, and I might not always have the highest emotional reaction to them, the highest, you know, 5 stars, it's great, but I can recognize, oh, there's something here that really speaks to me, and is it not quite connecting because it's the director's fault, or maybe it's just deeper than I'm willing to go? But this film, watching it the second time, it just spoke to me on a whole different level. It's still one I struggle with. Like, you could hear that. I'm like, what does this mean? What does that mean? But I think it's a struggle we're taking, going on this poetic journey of man finding his place in the world, maybe. But yeah, it's a recommend.
Stuart.
Yeah, just a side note in general about struggling with art films. I do find, just speaking personally, those tend to be the ones I like the most. Because, yeah, if everyone can enjoy a film, that's fine, but that's easy. What's more rewarding is when you can find a path into enjoying something that maybe initially you hated. You know, 2001, I didn't like that movie the first time I saw it. Now it's one of my favorite movies. That journey has helped it become one of my favorite movies, because you learn. You learn, I guess, how to connect with something that isn't obvious. And so that is the happy surprise here, is that a film that I didn't think was very original or different from the run-of-the-mill Criminals on the Run movie that counterculture was always celebrating in the 60s and 70s, Badlands is really groundbreaking and much better than I remembered from my single viewing on VHS 25 years ago. It is not a hick, Bonnie and Clyde, or Easy Rider. If anything, it's a rebuttal of those films and the way they glamorize youth culture violence and pick fights with the system. Kit and Holly truly are rebels without any justifiable cause. And in so doing, their crimes become more motivated by boredom, disillusionment, mental illness. Again, I keep calling them innocent, but it's only because they're so clueless about modern life. They don't seem to understand what we take for granted. I've never seen boomers portrayed that way. That is what they always say about Generation X. We get ascribed the numb, desensitized, addicted to vapid Americana culture. It's really interesting that Malick was the guy that pioneered that. That this movie, no wonder all those 90s indie people love his work. He was pioneering a form of stoner comedy, for lack of a better word, that would become in vogue 20 years after it came out. And so I learned to appreciate this movie more now. I used to appreciate it as a work of cinematography. That's what film school taught me. And that's still true here. The lyricism, the symbolism, it's all very poetic. It's all very beautiful. I also just think this movie's incredibly funny and kind of heartbreaking in a coming-of-age story told by a 15-year-old girl who, frankly, we don't have that many films prior to this where that kind of character would be given the floor and be made the central character of the story. I think this movie will be appealing to many different age groups. Yes, I think if you like 70s cinema, you must see this film. I'll say it that much. If you want to know about 70s cinema, you have to see Badlands. But I think some of those films, you know, like Easy Rider is not a film I think a lot of people can relate to now. I think today's generation can relate to this movie. Because as you said, Arnie, I do feel like for a generation that grew up eating organic and being placed on the autism spectrum, they're going to find some kind of kinship in the way that these numb characters try to find utopia within the drab parameters of conventional law-abiding society. For me, I have gotten to the point where I consider this a high recommend for a timeless story.
Well, thank you guys for discussing your thematic reviews of this movie without making me feel stupid for not getting it. Because, yes, I intentionally came into this movie as the newbie, somebody who'd never seen it before. And taking it as I did, a narrative of two morally ambiguous people, both of whom seem to have some sort of mental disorder about them, I think my reaction is kind of like yours initially was, Stuart. It's like, it's okay. I did think it was beautifully shot. I think the color palette, some of the angles used, and the scenery, the way that Malick does take complete use of the location shooting he's done and include all of the scenery behind it. So few of the shots of this movie are indoors. I mean, you mentioned her small bedroom. There's the scenes in the rich man's house, but the majority of this movie is outdoors and looks absolutely gorgeous for it. I also read, you asked about the 3DPs. I read that Malick was constantly running out of money on this and that he was barely able to complete the film and he had to take odd jobs just to finish the editing of it and things like that and get it done. So some of this stuff, I think I've discussed when my trip to MoMA, when they had the chair exhibit and it looked like I was at IKEA and they called it art. And so in some cases, I wonder if people are looking for art here and seeing God in places where finances just didn't come through to be what he perhaps had intended. But nonetheless, I can give this movie a recommend. I thought it was a good watch. And I mean, yes, I have a lot of questions about the motivations of the character. But other than Sissy Spacek's opening monologue, her voiceovers get so much better. But that opening one is a truly sour note. But other than that, I think these two actors play well together. They really play well off each other and take me along for the ride.
Well, good to know. Yeah. Again, I think that this movie has something for everyone. I don't think everyone's going to call it a masterpiece. And I do think a lot of times when you first come to it, you might feel like it's been oversold. You'll either go with it because you return to turns of phrase, images, moments of catfish being thrown in watermelon patches. Things stay with you. I don't know how else to put it other than there's just things that I can't shake off. Those are the kinds of movies that sometimes you spend so much time thinking about, they do become ones you treasure. I would say if you're more curious about Malick, if you want to know where else to go, the other one is the other 70s movie. Days of Heaven is maybe still my favorite one. It's another biblical story, but told in the 20th century. Peasants, it's a farmland. It's got Richard Gere, Sam Shepard, Brooke Adams. I really like it. It's a lovely, lovely film. All the other ones, I don't know. I like parts of them, but I can't say that I like them. Thin Red Line, The New World. You know, The New World's funny because the word on that was, it's the story of Pocahontas. And Christopher Plummer, when he saw the movie, apparently burst into tears because, like, Fields of Wheat got more screen time than he did in the film. Like, he was like, I had all these pages of dialogue. I say nothing in this film. You won't even notice me. All I can say is if Terrence Malick ever directs your school play, you want to be the tree. Like, he will give more time to nature and to flowers. Like, that is his passion.
That is the best part of the Tree of Life. I mean, watching the universe be born and a dinosaur make a moral choice. Like, that is the best part. Like, that spoke to me the most.
Malik can't determine whether humans are any more important than any flora or fauna. And so he can marginalize some major A-list talent. It's definitely true of Thin Red Line. It's definitely true in New World. Like, you'll just be surprised at how little some of these major actors play a role. Tree of Life, God knows. Yeah, it's a 50s coming of age story, and it's a dinosaur drama. I mean, I don't know. But I gave up. All I can say is he continues to be very prolific. He's put out three or four films since Tree of Life's Oscar nomination. It was up for Best Pictures, folks, but I have not watched them. And apparently Ben Affleck, even, who starred in one, To the Wonder, said, yeah, I don't know what this movie is about, and I would never make a movie like this. I just did it because it's Malick. And so if you like Malick, Malick's doing his thing. I am excited about the one he's got coming this December.
The trailer makes it look more straightforward.
Yeah. It's another story about naive people in farm country, but it's got a World War II premise. There are German peasants, and they're getting wind of what the Nazis are doing. And so the moral question is, what is the right thing to do if you believe your leaders are taking your country in the wrong direction, but you're just simple common folk?
I wonder where he came up with that idea.
What could that say about the here and now? I can't imagine, but it looks more character-driven. I see a lot of crops in the trailer, but I believe these actors will be giving some narrative storytelling. And I'm ready to embrace Malick if he's ready to embrace human beings a little bit more. Or be a little bit less of the painter and poet, more of the storyteller. But we're not covering that movie in December. We're covering something far less arty. Because Star Wars Episode 9 is coming, we thought this was a good time to get back to Flash Gordon.
Have you seen the color palette on that? Don't tell me that's not arty.
Yeah, it is amazing the pendulum swings we have on these patron picks, and I love it.
I own that Queen soundtrack on vinyl.
I haven't seen Flash Gordon since 1980 in theaters, so I'm looking forward to it. But Anthony, thank you for picking Badlands. I think we had a good discussion here. I hope you enjoyed it, and thank you for supporting our show. Thank you to all of the people listening to this also for supporting our show at whatever level you do. You guys truly are the lifeblood that keeps us going, and yeah, we've got a lot of interesting reviews coming up. Some Kubrick, some Spielberg, some Oscar-nominated films, and Flash Gordon, all in the coming months on this patron feed.
Yeah. Our world has got a whole lot. It's harder to do the show now, I'll be honest. Like, because before, if we're just doing a series of slashers, there's a rhythm to that. You know what it is, but my God, yeah, the pendulum swings, they keep me on my toes, and I do love it. And I do think so much that people want to hear us do that, donate to hear us do that, and keep showing up month after month. It means a lot that you guys are still here with us as November patrons. Thank you so much.
And you say harder, but I will say there's something nice about throwing us a curveball every once in a while. We've been doing this show, you know, it started in 07, you've joined us in 08, and the retrospective started in 09, you know, so we've been doing this 10, 11, 12 years. I like that there are new challenges to be found.
Mm-hmm.
At certain point, I honestly can say I would have been very daunted to come into a review of Apocalypse Now. You know, yeah. There are certain movies, The Godfather, what more can you say that hasn't been said? And that people appear to enjoy our takes on them really is rewarding.
Yeah, I think, I don't know if we've gotten better, but if we did Badlands 10 years ago, I don't know that we would have been able to, it wouldn't have been the same show. I think that's for sure. We weren't there yet. In our mind, in discussing film, I think that we broadened our taste and you guys came with us, and that means everything.
But I would still call The Aviator artistic douchebaggery no matter what year.
But you know, it's been almost 10 years. If you haven't seen a movie in 10 years, you probably should go back and watch it again.
It's the way of the future. So thank you again to everyone. And now, Jacob Stewart, how about I go buy you a nice thick steak?
In the stench and slime of the feedlot, he'd remember how I'd looked the night before, how I ran my hand through his hair and traced the outline of his lips with my fingertip. He wanted to die with me, and I dreamed of being lost forever in his arms.
Thank you to all the listeners who have backed us through our Podbean crowdfunding campaign, and we hope you've enjoyed this special bonus movie review podcast.
Did it go the way it's supposed to?
Yeah.
Is that all there is to it?
Yeah.
Without patrons such as yourself, we couldn't keep doing the shows we put out every single Tuesday. So thanks to you all.
Our time with each other was limited, and each lived for the precious hours when he or she could be with the other, away from all the cares of the world.
And a special thank you to Anthony Richards for his support of the show and choosing Badlands for our review.
You haven't seen me when I'm going after something.
The opinions expressed on Now Playing are those of the individual hosts and may not reflect the opinion of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Yeah, well, nobody asked me what I thought. I'm just hanging on me.
Venganza Media Incorporated is not affiliated with the motion pictures reviewed or otherwise referred to herein.
We lived in utter loneliness, neither here nor there. Kit said that solitude was a better word because it meant more exactly what I wanted to say.
All movie clips and music included in this podcast are the intellectual property of the respective copyright holders. They are included here for the purpose of review and no infringement is intended.
You want to call the police, that's fine. This movie's so hot for me.
Now Playing Podcast is an exclusive trademark of Venganza Media Incorporated and may not be used without the expressed written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated. All rights reserved.
Kit felt bad about shooting those men in the backs, but he said they'd come in like that and they would have played it as down and dirty as they could.
Now Playing is a Venganza Media production, copyright 2019. All rights reserved. And no part of this show may be reproduced, repurposed, or redistributed without the written permission of Venganza Media Incorporated.
Something must have told him that we'd never live these days of happiness again, that they were gone forever.